You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Dramatic scenes in Hong Kong overnight, with authorities taking a tough line against...
September 28th, 2014. This is the day that Hong Kong changed forever. But what leads to the day? I'm going to provide you some context first. Hong Kong's top official, the chief executive, is not democratically elected. It is currently chosen by a 1,200-member election committee made up of representatives from four sectors with 300 members each. The 300 members of each sectors are then divided into groups which represent different professions. For example, under the industrial, commercial and financial sector, its subsectors included catering, hotel, tourism and real estate. However, it is near impossible for grassroots Hong Kongers to become representatives of their own profession, which I'll demonstrate using some subsectors. When I mention the catering industry, you might think of the people who are chefs, waiters or even dishwashers can choose their representatives. That's not the case. The reality is, only those who hold food licenses or members of big catering management associations can choose who will be on the committee. And on the finance subsector, instead of bank tellers or accountants, the industry's representatives are chosen by corporate votes. The bosses of the 156 corporate bodies that are banks and deposit-taking companies. Since its implementation in 1998, the committee has been compared to a black box, as its composition heavily favoured those pro-Beijing and has business interests. Pan-Democrats for years have campaigned to abolish the committee and establish universal suffrage to elect the chief executive. By January 2013, there were already plans to use radical means to bring universal suffrage to Hong Kong. The movement, named Occupy Central with Love and Peace, was founded by three people, Benny Tai, Chu Yuming, and Chan Kim Man. It proposed an act of civil disobedience be carried out in Central, the business and financial district of Hong Kong, if the government failed to announce reforms introducing genuine universal suffrage. The movement's manifesto stated that it will campaign for universal suffrage through dialogue, deliberation, civil referendum, and civil disobedience. It also demanded that any government proposal should satisfy international standards in relation to universal suffrage, such as equal number of votes, equal weight of each vote, and no unreasonable restrictions on the right to stand for election, and the final proposal for electoral reform be decided by a means of a genuine democratic process. The founders also emphasized their objective of non-violent civil disobedience. Tai says the movement uses self-sacrificing to win support from the public, which would give them a mandate, and by occupying the streets of Hong Kong's financial center would apply political pressure to mainland China and force them to go to the negotiating table. In late 2013, the Hong Kong government announced a reform on choosing the chief executive, which aimed to allow all Hong Kong voters to vote for the chief executive in the next election in 2017. However, on August 31st, 2014, a decision made by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, which is the legislative body of mainland China, set limits for the political reform. The decision states that candidates for the chief executive has to, quote, love the country and Hong Kong, to guarantee that a nominating committee modelled on the current election committee system will be formed to nominate two or three candidates, each of whom must receive the support of more than half of the members of the nominating committee. Democrats are enraged by the proposed reforms and called it a, quote, fake universal suffrage.
Bo-si-mo. 中央干預越來越多,好似免費電視牌照事件,立法會應否調查梁振英,中聯辦都要插手。Alan
Leong of the Pan-Democrat Civic Party says the reforms are causing Hong Kong to go backwards because the requirements under the new nomination committee will be more stricter than the current system, which makes it harder for potential Democrats to enter the race. They proposed nominating candidates using civil nomination, which candidates who receive a quota of nominations from ordinary voters will be allowed to run in the election. However, then Hong Kong Chief Executive CY Leung's government and other pro-Beijing individuals welcomed Beijing's decision. Then Chief Secretary Carrie Lam claims the reforms have improved Hong Kong's political situation by having 5 million voters choosing the chief executive instead of a 1,200-strong committee. She also blames the alternatives proposed by Democrats have, quote, deepened differences and damaged the trust between Hong Kongers.
Universal suffrage,
Regina Ip, a lawmaker from the pro-Beijing New People's Party and notoriously known for trying to implement mainland security law in 2003 when she was the Secretary for Security, says universal suffrage only ensures that every voter their right to vote and the process is fair, but not the right to nominate candidates. University and secondary school students also protested against Beijing's decision by boycotting classes. The campaign, jointly organized by the Hong Kong Federation of Students and secondary student activist group Scholarism, was participated by university students from the 22nd to 26th of September and also by secondary school students on the 26th of September. The movement demanded the National People's Congress retract its decision made on the 31st of August, Chief Executive CY Leung to restart the political reform process and propose a system that reflects what most Hong Kongers want. At the night of the 26th, leading student activists Joshua Wong, Alex Chow and Nathan Law scaled the fence and entered the forecourt of the east wing of the Hong Kong's government headquarters, known more commonly as the Civic Square. Police cleared the square next day and arrested 60 people, including the three leaders. During the day, the situation continued to escalate as other protesters started to arrive at government headquarters and skirmishes with police began. This is the police clashing with protesters in a nearby overhead bridge to government headquarters. At 1:38 a.m. on the 28th of September, Benny Tai announced the Occupy Central movement is in full effect. Tai says the student boycott campaign is Hong Kong's biggest civil disobedience movement and the occupation will start at Tin Mei Avenue, the street next to government headquarters. Tai also says the movement has started a new age in Hong Kong's history, which he describes as the age of resistance, and urged others to go to the area to support the movement. Around 4 p.m. on the 28th, the footpaths of Harcourt Road, the main road in front of government headquarters, could no longer contain the large numbers of demonstrators who were streaming to the location in support of those facing police pressure on Tin Mei Avenue. They spilled onto the busy road and traffic came to a stop. And at 6 p.m, riot police fired tear gas into the crowd. This is the first time since the handover to China that tear gas has been used in Hong Kong. However, nearly 50,000 protesters refused to disperse and they occupied Harcourt Road and neighbouring Connaught Road. Protesters in other areas such as Mong Kok and Causeway Bay also occupied roads. The occupied areas remained closed to traffic for 77 days, despite numerous incidents of violence by triads and thugs, particularly in the Mong Kok region, and other several attempts by the police to clear the area. Protesters held their ground for over 2 months. After the Mong Kok occupation area was cleared on the 25th of November, the government headquarters and Causeway Bay occupied areas were also cleared with no opposition on the 11th and 14th of December, respectively. The political reform itself was expected not to pass in the Legislative Council because the results was expected to be 41 votes in favour to 28 votes opposed, 6 votes from a required 2/3 absolute majority. But what happened during the day of the vote was an embarrassment to the pro-Beijing camp. Right before the vote, 33 pro-Beijing legislators walked out to wait for a member so he could cast his vote. 8 of their colleagues did not follow suit, and with all 28 pandemocrats present, the quorum of 35 was met in the House. Therefore, the reform was defeated in a landslide by 8 votes in favour to 28 votes opposed. The Occupy Central movement has changed Hong Kong forever. The rift between different political camps diverged, and new political ideas on Hong Kong's relations with China emerged. But why? And what does that mean? I first talked to Agnes Chow, a member of Demasisto, a political group evolved from scholarism. She was a spokesperson for scholarism during the Occupy Central movement and tried to run for a Legislative Council seat earlier this year, but her nomination was disqualified because the government has deemed her beliefs illegal. In your opinion, how has Hong Kong changed these 4 years after the Umbrella Revolution?
I would say that the suppression from the Chinese government and the Hong Kong government is becoming more and more severe, especially after the Umbrella Movement, because there are more like opposing opinions to the government from the general public, which makes the Hong Kong government do want to use different methods to try to stop those opposing opinions. And today, when we watch the news, we can see that the government announced that all of the activities of the operations of the Hong Kong National Party, which is a political party who advocates Hong Kong independence, is now known as illegal. So you can see that the Hong Kong government is trying to use different ways to suppress and stop all of the opinion, opposing opinion, especially the voices advocating self-determination and Hong Kong independence. So maybe in the future, Demasisto will also be announced by the government that our activities are illegal.
All right, speaking of your party, Demasisto, given that Joshua Wong and Nathan Law, obviously, who are very well known in Hong Kong as well in the international stage, can't run for the next Legislative Council election because they are convicted, and you were disqualified running in the Hong Kong Islands by-election earlier this year, what's next for Demasisto?
We'll not see ourselves as our political party anymore, but a political organization. We are not aiming at running at election and getting seats in the electoral anymore, but we're trying to do a lot of work, political work and promotions on different issues and policies that we think unjust. For example, the national anthem law that the Legislative Council is probably discussing within this year, that is kind of limiting the right of kind of the free of speech and the right to express their opinion. So we are doing actually a lot of promotions on the National Anthem Law, and also we are showing our concern on different national education related issues. And we are checking on different textbooks that we think are problematic or with problematic content or kind of patriotic content. So although we couldn't run for election, but we believe that in our position, we can still do a lot of work in telling Hong Kong people that there are lots of problematic issues or policies proposing by the government.
On to localism. After the protests, we saw many new figures of our generation advocating for Hong Kong independence, especially someone like Edward Leung. Will Dem and Sisto, as a political organization, work with them?
And of course, we won't mind cooperating with different groups who advocate democracy. And I believe that for the pan-democrats, the self-determination camp, and for the pro-Hong Kong independence parties, we are all facing the powerful and hardline policy from the Chinese government, and we are all the ones suppressed by the Chinese government and the Hong Kong government. And it is very important for us to stand together or to work together.
My final question is on to Hong Kong's future. Do you think Hong Kong will be more democratic or vice versa in the next few years under Carrie Lam or other political leader?
I don't think that the political situation or the level of democratization in Hong Kong really depends on who is the chief executive, because the chief executive in Hong Kong is also directly kind of controlled by the Communist Party, that they have to follow the direction, the political direction and the line to take of the Chinese government. So the most important thing for me is, first of all, how Hong Kong people think about their hometown. Do Hong Kong people really care about their hometown? If we really care, it is very important for Hong Kong people, for more Hong Kong people to stand up and care for the community. That's why we are also doing lots of promotion works and community organization works to try to let people aware of different social issues in Hong Kong. The second factor is, of course, the policy or the line to take of the Xi Jinping's government, because in throughout these few years, we can clearly see that presidency is taking a very hardline policy towards Hong Kong and towards the opposition side or opposing opinion, that leaders put in jail, people are candidate are disqualified, etc. So in the future, well, I believe that he will continue to take this hardline policy, which will make the process of democratization in Hong Kong become more and more severe.
I also talked to Dr. Kenneth Chan, a former Hong Kong lawmaker for the Civic Party and a current associate professor in the Department of Government and International Studies at the Hong Kong Baptist University. In your opinion, how has Hong Kong changed these 4 years after the Occupy Central movement?
Well, against the background of the umbrella movement, which was about, of course, democracy, human rights, and better governance for Hong Kong, I think the situation in Hong Kong since then has gone from bad to worse. In essence, if one country, two systems promised Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy, what happened over the past 4 years, in my view, has been a further weakening I would say near collapse of that promise about a high degree of autonomy for Hong Kong. Many aspects of the government policy making, developments of Hong Kong have become increasingly put under Beijing or national planning and directions. And that, to my mind, is a very disturbing and unhealthy development.
Following on what you just said, now the government has done many things such as jailing those advocating for greater Hong Kong autonomy or independence and banning them to run for a seat in the Legislative Council. Do you think the government or Beijing can get what they want in the end, which is deterring young people from aligning themselves with political movements?
Well, clearly the pro-democracy movement has suffered setbacks since the end of the umbrella movement. As you suggested, potential aspiring young candidates for our Legislative Council have been disqualified on dubious grounds. Our freedom of speech, our freedom of press, academic freedom are under threats by Beijing, and of course those pro-Beijing individuals and political groupings in Hong Kong. I think the whole atmosphere has become quite depressing for any young and aspiring activists to imagine themselves having much room of maneuver. Having said that, however, I think it would be foolish if Beijing or the Hong Kong political elites, the pro-establishment ones particularly, have come to the conclusion that this is the end. Quite the contrary, I think a lot of strong anti-Beijing, anti-establishment sentiments have accumulated. So I think we haven't seen any proper institutional or constitutional solutions to the tensions, to the disagreements that led to the rise of the umbrella movement in the first place. So those issues are still with us. It's a very precarious situation. And if the government or Beijing has or about to do something that would provoke these kind of disaffection and anti-establishment sentiments, I'm sure that once again the pro-democracy movement and the young people, the activists, would come together again in opposition.
But having you said that, many young people in Hong Kong, particularly some of my friends, have already lost all confidence and don't believe they are able to change the political situation. Mm-hmm. What should they do? Or should I say, what should others do?
Number one, we understand from similar struggles for freedom and democracy around the world, from the past as well as from contemporary developments. It's very important for activists to learn how to overcome hopelessness, to learn how to overcome a sense of powerlessness. It's easier said than done, of course. But look, the last thing I want to see for these young and aspiring people or friends of ours is to surrender to the kind of self-fulfilling prophecies that the situation is hopeless, nothing we can do about the situation, we just let go or we just leave it as it is, because that would actually help the establishment. It would actually help Beijing to increase the oppression, to stamp on our aspirations for a fairer and more sort of liberal and democratic system of governance for Hong Kong and for the rest of China. So the more effective, in my view, the measures for us now is to keep up that kind of optimism, to overcome hopelessness and powerlessness, and to remind ourselves, do not succumb to self-fulfilling prophecies that would further weaken civil society. And I remain hopeful because when I look around, on the face of it, of course, you don't see massive demonstrations, lots of civic activism on the streets or on the occasions of when electrical debating controversial issues. However, there are civil society groupings, activists, they still work very hard to speak up and stand up for human rights and democracy in Hong Kong. They go to the United Nations hearings, they go to different parts of the world, they connect with one another. So beneath the surface, let's look a little bit closer. There are still people working very hard for Hong Kong for the good cause. And I do believe that young activists, apart from chasing the media limelights or feeling a little bit upset about the lack of progress, there's still in Hong Kong enough room for them to contribute.
onto the Democratic camp. Like, during these 4 years, the Democratic camp has seen open division. For example, like, your party founder Ronnie Tong has defected to the pro-Beijing establishment, or four-term legislator Frederick Feng has defied the camp's decision to let younger candidates run for parliamentary seats. As an academic yourself, does it mean the Democratic camp is having trouble on integrating old beliefs with new ideas brought by the current young leadership?
I think as a movement, we understand there will always be people coming in and people going away. Of course, there are always factors such as personal ambitions, career considerations, if you like, among politicians of all shades and backgrounds and orientations. However, what is significant to my mind at this moment, the stage of the democracy movement, is that we seem to be more united than before. It's actually easier than before to get together, because obviously, the establishment of Beijing have stepped up their campaigns against Hong Kong's autonomy, against the democracy movement in particular, against free speech and academic freedom and free press. And therefore, on the basis of shared values or core values, if you like, I think the pro-democracy parties and individuals tend to be more willing to stand together than before. In the past decade or so, or at least since 2003, we've seen, of course, proliferation of new political parties, new ideas, the rise of some radicalism on the fringes in order to get enough votes to be elected to electoral. Yes, I mean, obviously, it's all politics at the end of the day, nothing surprising. But now facing a very strong autocratic, I would say, a counterattack on the movement. I think, in my view, I'm more hopeful that we can overcome lots of old differences and build new alliances and reaching out to different sectors of the population. There are setbacks, of course, such as the last Carlton West by election, in which we witnessed the loss of Dr. Edward Yu in that particular election. But we pick ourselves up. We learned the hard lessons, and hopefully this time around we stand even more united. There will be always individuals, if you mention Mr. Frederick Feng, for example, who happen to have different considerations for himself. But I think at the end of the day, this is what democracy demands. It's about, you know, people understanding better, understanding more, and hopefully this time around, standing united, the voters would come with us and get the seats back for us.
Well, when you speak of unity, there's no denying that after the movement, Hong Kong saw the rise of different localist groups who opposed the pan-democratic way of holding the government to account. And being a former lawmaker of the Democratic camp, what do you think of this?
Well, at the end of the day, the democracy movement is a broad church. And no one should be in the position to say who is definitely not, or who is definitely right, or who is definitely wrong. I think we, again, as I said, we've learned the hard lessons over the past decade or so. And now, if anybody is trying to say that, oh, you know, I'm the only way, or I'm the only correct way, I think they are not really being honest about the cruel realities. So I very much hope that whatever branding, whatever logo, whatever banner members of the pro-democracy movement would like to be seen to be affiliated with, the clear line of division is actually between us and them, us being Hong Kongers fighting for Hong Kong's democracy and autonomy and rights, them being the autocrats under the Xi Jinping regime. So this division is the most important division. It's a political division, and underneath there can be different shades, diversity, but I think there could be unity in diversity, and that might serve Hong Kong better that way.
So what do you mean is, on some issues that the Democratic camp can work with localists, in especially inside the Legislative Council, despite a difference in the agendas?
I never heard of anybody saying that we don't want to work with anybody, to be honest. The truth is, I mean, what's the point of weakening ourselves, enfeebling ourselves, or marginalizing ourselves when the call for unity should be the most important one at this critical juncture? In terms of personal branding or in terms of personal interest in getting some attention, I do understand that. This is the logic of politics in a way, especially in the case of Hong Kong when it's so media-driven day in, day out. But putting those away, I think we are sensible and clever enough to see, as I said, where exactly the major political division in Hong Kong. And it wouldn't achieve anything by weakening the movement, by emphasizing divisions that can be easily managed. I'm not saying that they will vanish, but we can definitely manage divisions or disagreements or differences. And, well, we will see. I mean, I very much hope that everybody understand that simple fact of life in Hong Kong politics today.
Will Hong Kong move forward democratically or vice versa in the next few years, in your opinion?
Well, I don't have the crystal ball to tell you. Everybody would probably say such things if you ask a question about the future. I think this is an uphill battle. No one should say otherwise. It's an uphill battle. It's going to be difficult as China is becoming increasingly autocratic. Hong Kong, Hong Kong's prospects of democracy are bleak. But does it mean that we give up? Does it mean that we don't cherish what we already have and try to stand firm and speak truth to power and fight whenever we see freedoms and our aspirations being stamped upon? I don't think Hong Kong people would give up. I think Hong Kong people are quite sophisticated people. We do have a busy life to live, but at the same time, we do have something that we cherish. If you just look at, for example, the overall performance of this Carrie Lam government after CY Leung, well, Hong Kong people would welcome some sort of room to breathe. But at the same time, I don't think we have given up our aspirations or our very high demand for good governance from the political leaders. And I believe that there would always be opportunities for the democracy movement not only to fight for democratic changes, but actually fight for Hong Kong. I think we are on the same page.
And the last question, and this is from a friend of mine back in Hong Kong. Despite the Occupy Central movement has made more young Hong Kongers concerned about local politics, one of its biggest consequences is fracturing the democratic camp. If you, Kenneth Chan, as a lawmaker back then, and you were given a choice, would you hope the movement never happened?
Oh, well, we can't go back on the clock and say that when I wish it done differently. And that's what we call, counterfactual, ahistorical in terms of methods of thinking or logic. I think what happened. There were reasons or logics behind the development of the umbrella movement and how it started, and how it ended. As I said, this is actually quite common in pro-democracy struggles, not only for Hong Kong, but, looking around and looking back in history. I think we can learn a lot from past experiences, good ones as well as not so good ones. And I would not, go back and think, we've done something very bad. It should never have happened this way or that way. What happened, happened. Now, I remain always hopeful and optimistic, not only because I was born an optimist, but simply because, judging from history, we have seen setbacks million times worse than what we've got here in Hong Kong. And if those setbacks, including bloodsheds, more severe jail terms, purges, persecutions, nonstop, a right terror, in those in those countries, in those episodes, why should we be so kind of upset or pessimistic about Hong Kong? We have so much with us, and we have to learn how to cherish. If we haven't learned, it's time to learn. We have still room to operate in civil society in LegCo. Let's try to take advantage of these opportunities and do something good for ourselves and for Hong Kong people. So at the end of the day, if you don't look just at your own self and where you are, but look bigger, look at the bigger picture, I think we can all find ways and means to work together for a better Hong Kong. That's what I believe in. That's what I've always believed in.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.